I'd like to welcome everybody to the Court of Appeals this afternoon. We have two cases set for oral argument. This will be the first one, obviously. We have another one set at 2:30, which y'all are welcome to stick around and listen to if you want. Obviously, you don't have to. So I understand that counsel have all checked in and informed the clerk of the times that you would like to argue. So before we get started, I'll introduce the panel that we have today. To my left is Justice Brian Walker. To my right is Justice Dabney Basil, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. So with that, I'll ask the clerk to call the case.
The court will now call Petition Hayes International versus JDH Pacific Incorporated. May it please the court, Ms. Marcy Tobin Greer will argue for the appellant. Mr. Malcolm Whitaker will argue 10 minutes for the appellee. Mr. George Berman will argue 10 minutes amicus.
Thank you.
May I proceed?
Yes.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. The Federal Arbitration Act and the Texas General Arbitration Act have extremely differential and strong presumptions in favor of arbitral awards, such as the one rendered in this case. Unless grounds are offered for vacating, modifying, or correcting the award, the court shall confirm the award. That's section 171.087 of the Texas Arbitration Act, similar provision in section 9 of the FAA. The order in this case vacating the arbitral award gave no deference to the arbitration process or the merits. The arbitrator, Roland Johnson, entertained multiple hearings as well as 6 days of evidentiary proceedings, 9 witnesses, hundreds of pages of briefing, probably thousands of exhibits, and he resolved all 11 of JDH's substantive claims as well as 3 of PHI's claims. The district judge vacated the entire award without providing any reason. None of the reasons that JDH has offered to that court or to this court is grounds for vacating the entire award. Even more to the point, none of the grounds lacks merit at all, but even if you give JDH credit on each of the arguments it has made, you still get to a point where there's only one claim for attorney's fees or garnishment that is not, quote, within the scope of the arbitration agreement. There's no law that suggests that you throw an entire arbitration award out simply because one of the claims may have been beyond the arbitrator's jurisdiction. Now, we don't concede that it was, and I'm going to address that in a minute, but even if the court were to accept that, you have no basis for upholding the vacatur of the entire award. So JDH's first argument is that the arbitrator lacked jurisdiction over the wrongful garnishment claim. And we talked about the scope of the arbitral provision, which is very, very broad. It's all disputes arising out of or relating to. That's the broadest formulation in Texas law and under the FAA as well. We also talked about the fact independently that the parties incorporated the AAA rules specifically into their arbitration agreement as further evidence that they intended a very broad scope of the arbitration. Now, a lot of briefing has been provided to the court about potential differences of opinion over whether an incorporation of the AAA rules is sufficient to show a clear and unmistakable intent to delegate gateway issues to the arbitrator. That issue is one that the court need not reach here because it is not dispositive. Even if this gateway issue should have been decided by the district court, it should have been decided in favor of arbitration. There simply is no argument that this agreement, this wrongful garnishment claim, is outside the scope of this broad agreement that the parties entered into.
Do you have any guess about what the Texas Supreme Court's going to do in the Total case?
I don't, but in the Total case, well, first of all, we're at the reply brief stage for the PFR, so we don't know if they'll even reach it, much less when. But I don't know. I mean, what's really interesting about that case, though, is that they're only arguing about a narrow arbitration provision, which is very different. In that case, there were 2 arbitration awards. One has an arbitration provision, one does not. And so there was evidence that the arbitration award, the contract that did not have the arbitration award, was not intended to go to arbitration, but instead to the exclusive jurisdiction of the Harris County courts. And so that's a very different case. And I think the Trafigura case is probably the best explanation of where the courts are on this, because the courts of appeals, and it concludes, it surveys all of the cases that have been decided to date, and it concludes that of all the courts of appeals who have found the incorporation does not show clear and unmistakable intent, those are cases where there were other indicia that the parties did not intend to refer everything to arbitration. But again, the court, even if the court resolves that issue in favor of the judge being the gatekeeper here, it doesn't change anything, because the trial court should have found that the wrongful garnishment claim was within the scope. Judge Miller, Gray Miller, U.S. District Judge, already found that. He was very clear, and we've given you his orders in this case. JDH removed the case that was filed in Fort Bend County to federal court. Judge Miller upheld the removal and dismissed the case and sent it to arbitration. And JDH went there and tried to get these very same fees from Judge Miller. And he said, no, you live and die by that sword. Your claims for attorney's fees need to go to arbitration. So a judge has already decided the gateway issue. And the judge below should have made the same decision, because this is such a broad, broad scope. I mean, if you look at, I was in preparing for this argument, I came across this court's decision in Mid-America versus Trojan, where the court looked at a similarly broad form arbitration clause. And it was a case where the parties were attempting, it was a tenant-landlord-tenant dispute. And the claim was, you wrongfully went in and took all my things out of my apartment that I was leasing from you in breach of the lease.
What year was that case?
The year was 2021. Okay. It was October of last year.
I know the guy that wrote it, so I'll let you.
And in that case, they tried to claim, they made a lot of similar arguments to the ones that JDH has made here. And the court articulated it, consistent with other courts of appeals, that when you have this kind of broad form clause, quote, only if the facts alleged stand alone or are completely independent of the contract is the asserted cause of action not subject to arbitration. So this is a scope issue that the court should have considered. So how could the fees that JDH supposedly incurred in enforcing the arbitration provision in the license agreement not arise out of or relate to the agreement itself containing the arbitration clause? They've never provided a satisfactory answer to that. They've tried, you know, termination. Well, the agreement terminated. We've demonstrated why the cases that they argue about don't support that. A similar argument was made in the Mid-America Apartments case. And the court said that's just not the test. The test is, does the right arise out of the agreement? Well, the ability for JDH to get its attorney's fees arose exclusively out of the agreement. These license agreements govern the entire relationship between these parties. So there's really no basis for attenuating the wrongful garnishment claim, because it would not have existed but for the license agreements containing the arbitration agreements. So neither the district judge nor the arbitrator could have concluded that this wrongful garnishment claim was outside the scope. That takes care of most of their claim about attorney's fees too, because if the wrongful garnishment was within the scope, even their argument, which is wrong as we've demonstrated, that somehow the fees are tied in some way to the garnishment claim, they're not. But even if you were to credit that, that goes out, because the wrongful garnishment claim, in fact, all 14 of the claims were within the scope of the arbitrator's power and what was the dispute that was delegated to him to resolve. And it should not be forgotten that JDH is the one that compelled arbitration. They're the ones who wanted arbitration. It was only when they didn't get the result that they wanted that they jumped back into a different court, state court here, to try to vacate the award. Didn't try to modify it to carve off this wrongful garnishment claim, but tried to throw the whole thing out. And the attorney's fees issue has kind of morphed. At first it was just excessive and it's tied to garnishment. Now it's more of an apportionment claim. But as this court knows, you know, from the teachings of the Supreme Court and its own opinions, apportionment requires a record. There is no record in this case. And so the court can't second guess Mr. Johnson's decision.
Does the lack of a record from the arbitration have any bearing on how we view whether Mr. Johnson made a reasoned award?
No, Your Honor, that's a different challenge, and that's to the form of the decision. And clearly that is a challenge not to what he did, but whether he gave enough narrative to support it. And there are several reasons why that claim doesn't get you to vacatur here. First of all, as the case that they rely upon, Stage Shores versus Gunnarsson, says, the remedy is to send it back to the arbitrator for more findings.
Did someone ask the district court to do that?
Yes, we did. Okay. In response to the motion to vacate, we absolutely asked for that and said that was the only power that could be done. I mean, JDH never asked the arbitrator for additional findings, never said the award was insufficient, and instead in court just said it's not a reasoned award. But there, the court should not remand here because this arbitration decision is more than adequate. A reasoned opinion is somewhere between a bare recital and findings of fact and conclusions of law.
I mean, you're saying we should not remand, we should render is what you're saying.
Agree. Yes, Your Honor, because Mr. Johnson's award recites everything that it needs to. And keep in mind, the agreements themselves do not require a reasoned award, and they don't define what that is. This is something that came up on the record at the arbitral hearing, which, of course, we don't have a record of. And so we have to presume that Mr. Johnson understood what the parties wanted and gave it to them in the form of the order that's here. And so there's really nothing there. But at the end of the day, there is not a single argument that JDH has made here that would render vacatur appropriate. Now, they raise this issue of not serving with citation through the sheriff, which I think is a red herring at best. And I will address it since it's one argument that they've made. But it doesn't make a lot of sense because what we're challenging is the motion to vacate being granted. And they don't claim that there's no jurisdiction over that. In fact, it's kind of interesting. Only after we appeared and filed a motion to confirm did they even bother to issue the citation. So it's this pro forma defect that makes no sense. The record is very clear that JDH's counsel was served with the motion to confirm. No question about it. They responded to it and opposed it in the trial court. So the service was sufficient under Rule 21A, and there's been no challenge to that. And this idea that you have to go and do something pro forma when the parties are before the court, citation is necessary to bring jurisdiction of the trial court over a party. Once we appeared and engaged, there was no point in a citation. And I think that's, again, just a red herring. So at the end of the day, there's really no basis for upholding this award. It's going to have to be reversed, and the question is, what then?
So let me change gears just for a second and ask you whether there's anything about, I know that, I guess it was just yesterday, y'all got an extension to file a requested response in their petition for review from the 14th Court's decision. Is there anything about that appeal that would have any bearing on what we would do?
Your Honor, there's nothing about that. I mean, what the Court of Appeal found in three different opinions is that there was no jurisdiction to entertain the garnishment action. So the garnishment itself was void. The one justice is all it takes to require a response. A response has been requested. I feel pretty certain when they read the response, it will be over at that point. But even if they were to say the garnishment action was valid, which is difficult for me to conceive, but I'll spot that just for purposes of this discussion, it doesn't change the fact that the only ground, the only basis that JDH had to go and seek that garnishment was the attorney's fees award that it claimed it was entitled to under the terms of the agreements containing arbitration, and in even more so, I mean, more to the point, in enforcing the arbitration clause. So I don't see how you can say that's beyond the scope of this extremely broad arbitration clause. If the court has no further questions, I'll save for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Whitaker.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name's Malcolm Whitaker, and I'm here today on behalf of Appellee JDH. And I want to start by thanking Professor Berman, who's here to talk about his excellent amicus brief explaining why reference to the AAA rules is not clear and unmistakable evidence of an intent to exclusively delegate arbitrability to the arbitrator.
Do we need to even get to that argument if we agree with the appellant that that their wrongful garnishment claim would have been subject to arbitration no matter who decided the question?
Let me think about that for a moment. I'm watching my clock run down here, but if the wrongful garnishment counterclaim is within the scope of the arbitration agreement, then presumably you wouldn't need to reach that issue. I say that with some hesitation, but you're probably right there.
Do you agree that that cause of action arose from arbitrable issues?
Absolutely not, Justice Bassel. And two things that I'm disappointed that we didn't hear in Precision Hayes' argument. Precision Hayes sued JDH in state court, was removed to federal court. All of their claims were dismissed with prejudice.
Well, but wasn't that because you moved to compel arbitration, and at least within a lot of the Fifth Circuit courts, instead of abating the case pending arbitration, they'll just dismiss it with prejudice?
No. I'm sorry, ma'am, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Okay.
No. So typically in the Fifth Circuit, they dismiss without prejudice, right? They say go to arbitration. In this case, there was a co-pending motion to dismiss. JDH had a co-pending motion to dismiss. The judge said, I'm going to deny the co-pending motion to dismiss as moot. I'm going to grant the motion to compel arbitration, and I'm going to dismiss with prejudice.
And you view that as a decision on the merits?
I do. Dismissal with prejudice is a dismissal on the merits. If it's not, I mean, otherwise, what's the difference between a dismissal with prejudice and a dismissal without prejudice? I mean, is it a dismissal with prejudice kind of light? No, it's a dismissal with prejudice. There's a final judgment. If you look in the record, there's a final judgment that Federal Judge Miller signed. I would say that I think that my friend Ms. Greer is missing something, right? The wrongful acts complained of all occurred, and this is undisputed. The contracts were terminated April 15, 2019. August 18th was when the alleged wrongful garnishment was filed, 16 months afterwards, right? The alleged wrongful acts did not occur until 16 months. And in the Litton case, the U.S. Supreme Court case, Litton talks about a post-expiration grievance can only be said to arise under the contract only where, and it gives you a three-part test. And one of the tests is where the acts complained of, sorry I'm being so emphatic, where the acts complained of occurred before termination. We don't have that here.
I'll grant you that. And if this arbitration provision just said arising out of, I might be more inclined to agree with you, but it also says or related to. And I was looking at Justice Jefferson's merits brief in the Total case, and he draws a distinction and says that, you know, it's well settled that related to, in contrast to narrower phrases like arising out of, extends to, quote, all disputes between the parties having a significant relationship to the contract, regardless of the label, or that touch matters covered by the contract. So why is not a wrongful garnishment action something that relates to the licensing agreements?
Well, I'm burning through my time quickly, but the very short answer is because words have meaning. Words have meaning, and the words, which are found at CR 245 and CR 255 in the appellate record, the words of the agreements are all disputes, controversies, or differences arising out of or in relation to this agreement shall be submitted to binding arbitration in accordance with the rules of the American Arbitration Association.
And that was my question, the or in relation to. That's broader than arising out of, is it not? at least according to Justice Jefferson.
It probably is, but the way the courts have looked at that and the way the Texas Supreme Court has looked at that is they say, could the, I'm sorry, I had the words written down on a different page, could the claim be maintained without reference to the contract? The claim, and if that's the case, then the claim is not subject to arbitration. If we look at the counterclaim, Precision Hayes counterclaim, which is found at CR 277, and it's on page 12 of the appellee's brief, it doesn't reference the contracts. It doesn't mention the contracts, doesn't talk about breach of the contracts. And the Valero case, also from the 14th DCA, was a similar case where there was an allegation of misconduct, and the allegation was, well, it's all one big ball of wax and they're all related. No, Precision Hayes had control over its counterclaim. When they pled that, they chose not to talk about the contract. They pled that. I didn't plead that. JDH didn't plead that.
Didn't they incorporate all their factual paragraphs that had preceded that specific counterclaim?
They did, but they didn't need to rely on those. Those three paragraphs set out the elements for their wrongful garnishment counterclaim.
But they wouldn't have had a wrongful garnishment claim had you not garnished, which could only have happened because you had a contract with them.
I don't think that's true. Those things, that presupposes a lot that I don't think that we could have garnished with or without the contract. But
if there had been an attorney's fee award with respect to the breach of contract claim that was arbitrable, certainly that would have been part and parcel of the arbitration, correct?
And I'm sorry, may I ask you to repeat the question so
okay,
I answer it clearly?
If the arbitrator had awarded attorney's fees, not with respect to the wrongful garnishment, but just with respect to whatever the bundle of claims was with respect to this contract that was subject to arbitration, that attorney's fees award would have been properly arbitrable.
Yes.
And weren't you trying to recover attorney's fees via this garnishment in relation to that contract?
That was part of it, yes.
So that claim's not arbitrable?
No.
Okay.
It's not. And that's the case that I was just citing that says if the claim could be maintained without reference to the contract, then the claim is not subject to arbitration.
Even in the face of this broad and arbitration agreement?
Yes, and the reason that is because the words of the contract have meaning. You've got to, otherwise there would be no limit to the breadth of the arbitration agreement. If the arbitrator had considered a car accident between the parties when they were driving to the case,
well,
everything would be related.
In this case than that, isn't it?
We're talking about post-termination allegation of wrongful conduct. 16 months later, those cases were all closed. The legal cases in the state court and the federal court were all dismissed with prejudice. Those cases were all closed, done, finished.
Okay. Mr. Whitaker, how could y'all seek garnishment without contract, without privy to contract, without the contract? How could that happen, just out of curiosity?
Well, the only way for there to be a wrongful garnishment is if there is a false statement made in the affidavit, right? A false statement made in the affidavit. And the garnishment, the Texas Garnishment Code says that you can garnish if you have a liquidated sum and that is capable, and I didn't review this last night while I was preparing, liquidated garnishment that is capable of calculation. And I can't recall the exact words, but we believed we had a liquidated claim against Precision Hayes. We'd paid royalties to them over a period of years. We'd incurred attorney's fees. We believed that we had a liquidated claim, and the president of JDH signed that affidavit. And when he made those statements, they were true and accurate. And one of the statements that he made was not that there was subject matter jurisdiction.
Thank you very much. Your time is up. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. Officer Berman, welcome to Fort Worth.
Thank you very much, and good afternoon. May it please the court. I do want to thank the court for allowing me as an amicus to argue. I've filed many amicus briefs in my career, and I've never had the opportunity to make oral argument. Now, the question I'm addressing is one that, as the Chief Justice, Justice Kerr, mentioned, might not need to be decided. So I hope you will indulge me in my addressing this issue, even were it to be the case that it did not need to be decided. And I'm going to try to really fit this in, because when I teach this subject, it takes me three full days. So we don't have that.
You have 9 minutes and 20 seconds.
Yeah. So
we remember that experience. So.
Okay. So the starting point is the well-known first options case of the United States Supreme Court, with which I'm sure you're familiar. In that decision, a unanimous court said that the most fundamental feature of international arbitration is the consent of the parties to subject their disputes to arbitration. And equally fundamental is their right to independent judicial determination of whether they did, in fact, consent. So consent and access to a judge on whether they consented. And I want to be clear, we're nowhere talking about the merits of the case. I know the court appreciates that. Now, it's for that reason that Justice Breyer stated that that presumption that the parties consent is critical, and that they have the right to judicial review of an independent character, is so fundamental that it can be overcome only by, quote, clear and unmistakable evidence of what the court calls a delegation. Okay. Now, the proposition that I understand appellants are making is that clear and unmistakable evidence is established if there is found in rules of arbitral procedure incorporated by reference in the party's arbitration agreement, and if those rules of procedure contain a provision authorizing the tribunal to determine its own jurisdiction. In the literature on this subject, it's called competence, meaning competence to determine competence. I may use that term for shorthand if you don't mind. Now, that is the proposition. I have three basic arguments, I think any one of which would undermine that position. The first, competence, forgive me for using that term.
Competence. We like to hear French occasionally.
Actually, it's competence in German originally, but it gets translated in every language. In the United States, it has never been understood as disempowering courts. It has always been understood as empowering tribunals. Other countries interpret it differently. France is the poster boy for that. Therefore, we say we recognize positive competence. The French recognize positive and negative competence. So it is, I think, untenable to take a term like competence, which does not deprive courts of their power of independent review, and redefine it, give it a meaning it doesn't have, just because it's been inserted into rules of procedure. So on that ground alone, these decisions that take that position manifest a full misunderstanding and lack of knowledge of what competence means in the United States. And to establish that, one needs only look at the FAA or the Texas Arbitration Act. When those enactments were made, competence was already acknowledged. It was acknowledged even before these rules were drafted. And yet, the FAA, I'm going to read it if I can, in Section 4, says the court shall compel arbitration if, quote, satisfied that the making of the arbitration agreement is not an issue. And as you well know, after the arbitration, and an award is rendered, that award may be vacated where the arbitrators exceeded their powers. Now, what this tells us, because I want to move quickly, is that de novo judicial review is consistent with competence. They have coexisted. So it's a little disturbing to me personally that has been misunderstood. Now, the second argument is the following. First options, at a minimum, established a powerful presumption in favor of a party's right to de novo review of arbitrability or gateway issues, as they're also known. Now, if a competence clause is clear and unmistakable evidence of a delegation, there will always be a delegation, and first options will be turned on its head. Why do I say that? I say that because parties almost invariably incorporate procedural rules in their arbitration agreement. And those rules almost invariably contain a competence clause. So let's be practical about this. Relinquishment or loss of the right of access to a court for de novo review, loss of that is routine, practically universal. That cannot be what Justice Breyer intended. It is simply one cannot read first options and come to that conclusion. The two arguments I've given you, I think, suggest that this notion that these rules have the effect that have been assigned to them fails to meet the clear wing of the clear and unmistakable test. But I want to turn to unmistakability. It defies my understanding how any drafters of a contract that genuinely intended to make your loss of judicial review clear and unmistakable would bury that in a set of rules of procedure that are at best incorporated by reference in the arbitration agreement. I find that very difficult to accept. One has to assume that Justice Breyer didn't mean it when he said it had to be unmistakable, because it is mistakable.
Professor, don't you concede, though, that most of the occasions in which that kind of language enters into a contract is simply boilerplate that people are just referencing and using and copying and pasting literally into these contracts?
Absolutely. I don't know what bearing that has, though. Please enlighten me.
Sure. Well, no, go ahead.
Okay. Fine. So, unmistakable. You know, the Supreme Court of the United States has decided one and only one case on the question of whether clear and unmistakable evidence has been established. It's not the Shine case that has been referred to in the pleadings. It's Renter Center versus Jackson. That's the one and only case. And in that case, the arbitration agreement itself used the word exclusive. It said the tribunal shall have exclusive authority. And it wasn't buried in procedural rules that nobody reads until a dispute arises and arbitration is on the horizon. So it is a fantasy. It is a fantasy to think that that provision, buried in rules that no one will read at the time they sign their agreement, constitutes clear and unmistakable evidence of a relinquishment of this fundamental right. Now, I'm running out of time. I guess I want to say those are my three arguments. I hope you were able to distinguish them. There is no court that has taken the contrary view that has reasoned it. And I don't want to take the time, but if you look at page 20 of my amicus brief, you'll find the typical explanation, reasoning, which is if the arbitrators have competence, the courts can't. Definitionally, that's not adequate. That's not adequate, in my judgment. And every federal court that has rendered a decision since that time has simply followed its sister courts. And I think that's very unhealthy. I think it's very unhealthy for a federal court of appeals, rather than make independent judgment about a matter, does what its neighbor does. I find that deeply disturbing. Now, the last thing I want to say,
Fred, your time is up, but thank you so much
for thank you.
Giving us your thoughts. Sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Your Honors, if I could address Mr. Whitaker's argument first. He suggested that the dismissal with prejudice has some sort of res judicata or preclusive effect. And I think if the court will look, we provided you the opinion from Judge Gray Miller, which is tab 9 to our reply brief. And he was clear that PHI had requested a stay. And Judge Miller said a stay is not required when all the issues raised in district court have been submitted to arbitration. And the reason that the Fifth Circuit courts use a dismissal with prejudice at that point is because the claims are gone. They are only going to be pursued in arbitration. They will not come back to his court or any other court as claims. They will only come back enveloped in an arbitral award, which is judged by completely different standards. So it was appropriate for him to dismiss the claims with prejudice, and he was very clear. All the issues raised in this action, including interpretation of conditions preceding under the agreements, are arbitrable because all disputes arising out of or in relation to this agreement shall be submitted to binding arbitration. It's on page 7 of his opinion. So that is a non-issue. It was raised in the arbitral proceeding. We could get in a debate as to whether or not the arbitrator had jurisdiction to do that, but I think it's clear that he did because Judge Miller compelled it to arbitration. Going back to the after termination, Justice Kerr, you asked the question, why does in relation to not cover this dispute? And the answer is it does. I think arising out of jurisdiction would have been sufficient to cover this dispute because it arises only, it exists at only, if at all, from the license agreements. I mean, to prove their right to garnishment, they had to plead the license agreements. We've explained that we talked about the license agreements in our statement of claim, which is the document in the arbitration proceeding. I don't think there's any dispute that we knew that the arbitration agreement was the source of that claim. In fact, JDH sought its own attorney's fees in arbitration based on the licensing agreements containing the arbitration clauses. So this is really an attempt at redirecting the court. They simply wouldn't have had a wrongful garnishment claim if they had had it without that contract. The incorporation agreement of the AAA rules is really just icing on the cake. If you look back to PHI's motion to confirm, it's very clear that we were arguing broad scope of the arbitration provision as well as the arbitrator was delegated the gateway issue. Either one stands alone, but the court need not address the, quote, icing on the cake because there's a standalone reason to find that the garnishment was within the scope. As to the attorney's fees, I want to make it clear, I was not suggesting that the attorney's fees award had anything to do with the wrongful garnishment claim. They were not. We did not seek attorney's fees for wrongful garnishment. The court did not award them on that basis. It's clear from the arbitral award where those claims came from. And they even precede the adjudication of the wrongful garnishment claim. So I was just simply saying that even if those claims were tied in any way to the garnishment claim that was conceded to be outside the scope,
So, as I recall, it's been a while since I've read all this, but you were going on the prevailing party under the California rule that's in the 2012 agreement?
Correct.
For attorney's fees?
Correct, Your Honor. Mm-hmm. And that's where the source of the garnishment came from, and as Judge Miller recognized and compelled to arbitration in tab 8 to our reply brief. One brief statement about what rules are involved here, and it was the AAA commercial rules. Those were attached to our motion to confirm the award. Those were the rules the parties operated under at the arbitration. There's no mistake about that. But again, that's an issue that I think should be left to a case where it's truly case dispositive, as it is not here. I'm happy to answer any other questions if the court has them.
Nope. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, we very much appreciate the argument. It's been most helpful, and your case is submitted, and we'll take a break until the 2:30 argument. Thank you.